July 4th member-only doorbuster deals are on at Lowe's. Right now, rewards members save $50 on a select Charbroil 4-burner gas grill, now just $149. Plus, save over $500 on a Whirlpool top-load laundry pair, now $886. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, these July 4th doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/7 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, I want to remind everyone to please check out that series that we did on the Crusades at welcometothecrusades.com. Again, that's welcometothecrusades.com. We really think you'll enjoy it if you like history, if you like the Middle Ages, if you like learning about some crazy shit that happened in the past. And beyond that, we've got a very cool special announcement, something that we've been working on for a while. I think, Derek, Jesus Christ, since December. But we really think that you'll like it. It's a really cool thing. And Jake said that I needed to be a bit vague, but keep your ears out, I guess. Keep your eyes and your ears
your
out.
Eyes for, open.
Your eyes open, ears, your hearts open.
Yeah, your hearts. For sure.
For sure. Keep your hearts open. You always got to keep your hearts open. But check out that special announcement. So, Derek, why don't we dive into it? And let's talk about the PKK, which looks to be disarming.
Yeah, the Turkish government, the Turkish ruling party, the Justice Development, or AKP, announced on Tuesday, and the PKK has since confirmed this, I believe, on Wednesday or Thursday, that the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, will begin its disarmament process. You may recall that the party voted to disarm and dissolve back in May. This was after PKK founder Abdullah Öcalan earlier this year called for the party to dissolve, to disarm and dissolve. This is all wrapped up in negotiations that he's ostensibly undertaking with the Turkish government. There's still unclear what the Turkish government is actually doing here other than demanding the PKK surrender. But the party says it will begin within the next few days. The latest I've heard is sometime between July 10th and 12th in the northern Iraqi city of Sulaymaniyah, a group of PKK fighters. This is going to be a symbolic kind of ceremonial demonstration of intent rather than the real... disarmament. It will start the process of disarmament. A small group of fighters will symbolically turn their weapons over. Those weapons might be thrown on, some type of bonfire or something to destroy them, as again, a sort of symbolic statement of intent. And that will kick off this process that's supposed to continue on with the PKK, ultimately disarming and ceasing to exist, at least as a military entity or a militant entity. There are already some complaints emerging from within the PKK. One of its senior figures, a man named Mustafa Karasu, told Kurdish media earlier this week that he believes there is a group within the Turkish government that is trying to sabotage the peace process. And this has to do, again, with the lack of any substantive development on the Turkish side as to what the Turks are actually doing in return for the PKK taking these steps to will itself out of existence. The things that have been talked about, protections for Turkish Kurdish population, even just the cessation of regular airstrikes and attacks on Kurdish positions in northern Iraq, PKK positions. And the other thing that's been talked about is taking steps to ease the conditions of Öcalan's confinement, which has been quite brutal for many years now. None of that has manifested. There's been no practical movement on Turkey's part at all. So I think unless something like that emerges, at some point after this ceremony takes place, you're going to start to see this process maybe break down a little bit because it seems very one-sided at this point.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the IAEA's relationship with Iran, which is not going great right now.
No, not really. The International Atomic Energy Agency has been demanding that its inspectors be allowed to visit Iranian nuclear sites, which have now been, of course, heavily damaged, possibly destroyed. We don't really know how damaged over the course of the so-called 12-day war by repeated Israeli attacks and U.S. attacks. The Iranian parliament voted last week to suspend all cooperation with the IAEA. The Iranians are quite angry at the IAEA for doing basically nothing, saying basically nothing during the 12-day war as these sites were being bombarded, and then coming back at the end of it and having sort of the balls, let's say, to then demand site inspections. The Iranians are not pleased with this. So the parliament voted last week to suspend cooperation, and President Masoud Pezeshkian signed that into law on Wednesday. So at this point, there is no relationship between Iran and the IAEA. This is probably going to come up, you would think, in whatever negotiations may happen between the U.S. and Iran moving forward, if there will be any. The Trump administration has already been demanding that somebody get into these sites and do inspections, whether it's the IAEA or some other agreed upon group. But the IAEA is really the only one that would have the capability to do that, especially on short notice. So this is probably going to become a sticking point at some point. And it's unclear whether the Iranians regard this as a new permanent state of affairs, that they're just done with the IAEA altogether, or if this is potentially a negotiating ploy to, you know, kind of put this on the table and say, well, if you want us to let these inspectors back in, we have to get some kind of concession. Their hand is not very good right now after, you know, everything that's happened over the last few weeks. So, you know, they may be looking for ways to give themselves a little bit more negotiating leverage, but it's really unclear at this point.
And what about Iran being open to negotiations with the U.S.?
This has been back and forth. The Trump administration is, as of Thursday, saying there's nothing going on. The Iranians, Abbas Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister, who has been spearheading negotiations with the U.S., has expressed a certain amount of, publicly at least, a certain amount of reticence about resuming those negotiations, arguing there's really nothing to talk about at this point after everything has transpired. Nevertheless, there were reports over the last few days of a concerted push by the U.S., the Gulf states, pretty much anybody who can get a word to the Iranian government to try and get them back to the negotiating table, offering potentially concessions in terms of investment in a civilian nuclear program, although the issue of enrichment is still, still seems like it will be a major sticking point in any talks like that. There's been a report now from Axios saying that there is a tentative plan or a nebulous plan for Steve Witkoff, the de facto Secretary of State / Trump administration envoy, to go to Oslo at some point next week to meet with Araghchi. There's no date set for this, but it sounds from the reporting like the Iranians have agreed, at least in principle, to some kind of interaction. But that's still very up in the air, and it's also unclear what they'll be talking about. I can't believe that this would be another round specifically of negotiations over the nuclear program. It would have to be an attempt to convince Araghchi that it's actually safe and could be fruitful for the Iranians to reengage in the nuclear talks, because right now they have no reason to believe anything that comes out of the Trump administration or to trust that any negotiations would be done in good faith. So I would think there would be some convincing that would have to be done here. And this would be more of a preliminary kind of feeling the ground, testing the ground to see if resuming the nuclear talks is possible. But again, there's not even a date set yet, alone any kind of indication of an agenda.
And what do we know about how much damage the United States' attack on Iran did to its nuclear program?
We know very little. And that's because nobody's been to inspect these sites other than maybe the Iranians themselves. And it's not even clear that they're able to access them, especially Fordow, out of the enrichment facility that's underneath a mountain in Qom, was hit by those massive ordnance penetrator bombs that the U.S. dropped on it. Not even clear that they can get far enough into that facility to really assess the damage. But certainly anything else that's coming out of anywhere else is dubious at best. There have been varying assessments. I think we talked about this last week. The Donald Trump says the sites were all obliterated, including Fordow. The U.S. intelligence community said there was damage, but this probably only set the Iranian nuclear program back a few months. Rafael Grossi, the director of the IAEA, also is talking about the Iranians being able to scale up at least to kind of a low level enrichment program and you know get their nuclear program back on a small scale, also in a matter of months. There was a report in the Washington Post, I believe over the weekend, that the U.S. intelligence had intercepted some sort of communication between what they called senior Iranian officials, who said that the damage that they were finding was less than expected. The Trump administration throughout all of this has been insisting that anybody trying to do one of these, you know, assessments and saying it's been a matter of months or the damage isn't that severe is jumping the gun. And there's no way it's nonsensical to try and make these assessments so soon after the bombing. And yet it is also done in assessments itself, Trump in particular, but you know, the rest of his administration as well is doing its own assessments, also jumping the gun, that say, you know, we completely destroyed the program. It's been set back years. I will note that the Pentagon this week came out with its own assessment of 1 to 2 years. I don't think there's any reason to believe that this it has any basis in reality. I think most likely it was just meant to pacify Trump, and they know what Trump wants to hear, and they delivered him the assessment that he wanted. But I don't think there's any particular reason to give it a lot of credence. It's still very, very early to try and make these characterizations, and we really don't know a lot of details, for example, around, you know, what material the Iranians were able to move to safer sites or unknown sites that weren't bombed, whether they were able to move their highly enriched uranium stockpile or at least some portion of it out of the facilities where it was known to be kept to other places, or whether it's buried now and whether that stuff is buried now. We just don't know enough to make any really real assessment, it seems to me.
Let's talk about Gaza, and let's talk about this new push for a ceasefire.
This has been going on since the end of the so-called 12-day war, as Donald Trump has sort of seized on his sense of triumph and Israeli triumph as well in that conflict to say it's time to bring the conflict in Gaza to an end. On Tuesday evening, Trump got on social media to announce to the world that the Israeli government, I'm using his words now, has agreed to the necessary conditions to finalize the 60-day ceasefire, during which time we will work with all parties to end the war. That's word salad, but basically it puts the onus on Hamas to accept whatever proposals on the table, because allegedly the Israelis have accepted it. There's been no definitive statement, as far as I know, from the Israeli government that says we're ready to sign on the dotted line. But there has been reporting about the framework to which the Israelis have supposedly agreed. It includes as Trump said, 60-day initial truce, with negotiations, the same structure as previous ceasefires, with negotiations during that period on an indefinite ceasefire, theoretically, to follow. Hamas would release 10 living captives. That's half of the 20 that are still believed to be alive in Gaza, as well as the bodies of 18 deceased captives over that 60-day truce. What's a little bit different in this proposal as compared to past ones is that previous frameworks had had Hamas freeing those 10 living captives all at once at the beginning of the truce. And this one has them freeing, I think, 8 in the first few days, and then 2 more closer to the end of the 60-day period. The idea here, I think, is to assure Hamas that the Israeli government would remain engaged in these negotiations that are supposed to be going on while this is all playing out. There's also been reportedly some toughening of language around those issues, around, you know, kind of assuring Hamas that Israel would negotiate in good faith, that the negotiations might continue beyond the 60-day initial 60-day period, and that the ceasefire would continue as long as the negotiations continued. But nothing definitive, and really no reason for Hamas to assume that this would go any different than the previous ceasefire, which lasted 60 days and then it was over because the Israelis walked away from it. There's nothing to indicate that the U.S. is going to and exert any kind of real pressure on Israel to force it to accept an indefinite ceasefire. Nevertheless, there does seem to be a fair amount of speculation that Hamas will accept this ceasefire on these terms, with the supposedly tougher language and with the change in the sort of way that from previous proposals, in terms of the way that they the pacing at which they would release hostages. But we'll have to wait and see. Trump says he wants to have a deal by next week. Benjamin Netanyahu is supposed to visit the White House on Monday. Something may come out of that or after that. I don't think anything would happen before that. They might do it, you know, when he gets there. If there's a deal to be made, they might, you know, announce it then, or something might happen after after Trump and Netanyahu talk. I who knows, really.
Let's talk about these investigations into the massacres at the humanitarian aid sites.
Right. There have been two reports, one from Haaretz, the Israeli outlet, and one from the AP. The Haaretz report came out on Friday. It was basically kind of personnel in the IDF. So Israeli soldiers, lower level, I think, commanders on the ground. But mostly it sounds like, foot soldiers, telling Haaretz that essentially, yeah, they've been ordered, as anybody who could see this, you know, as plainly obvious, to anybody who's been watching the story, but that, they have been ordered, to open fire on crowds of people at these aid distribution sites. And we've seen massacre after massacre taking place. There's been dozens of people killed, hundreds of people at this point killed overall, but you know, we've seen very large massacres take place at these facilities. We've seen just on a daily basis almost, it's continued. The number of people killed in these kinds of incidents has dropped a bit on a day-to-day basis, but it's still continuing. These soldiers told Haaretz that they're deployed to these positions near the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid distribution sites, and they're not given any means of crowd control. The crowds of people, of aid seekers who approach these sites, aren't really given any instructions, and the only means of crowd control that they're offered is to fire on people, or ostensibly to fire warning shots. Of course, that's not really what's been going on. The reporting, you know, has been it's been rejected certainly by the Israeli government. They have Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel Katz, the defense minister, called the report blood libel. Which is fascinating because it, again, is based on testimony of IDF soldiers about what they themselves have been doing here. But it's really damning. It refers to these distribution centers as killing fields. Basically just says, you know, that they've been, senior commanders have been giving orders to fire on these crowds. The second report, as I said, comes from the AP and involves a couple of the mercenaries, essentially contractors, if you want to give it a nice name, U.S. mercenaries who have been contracted to provide security at these Gaza Humanitarian Foundation distribution sites, who told the AP that their colleagues, who they described as often unqualified, unvetted, heavily armed, who seem to have an open license to do whatever they wished, have also been firing. So it's not just the Israelis, apparently, who are firing on these people. It's also the mercenaries who are contracted to secure these facilities have also been firing. They've been using stun grenades, pepper spray, live ammunition, certainly. The company, the ironically named Safe Reach Solutions company that's been contracted to provide security at these sites, told the AP that it's seen only scattered instances of its personnel firing on crowds. And those all took place in the immediately after the GHF began operating during what they called the height of desperation on the part of the aid seekers, the starving Palestinians. So, you know, everybody's trying to sort of downplay this. And it's but even as it's sort of plain to see what's been going on, it's just confirmation to hear it from people who are directly involved in it.
Let's talk about Afghanistan, where Russia has recognized the Taliban government there.
Yeah, this is a big deal. The Russian government on Thursday, and this just happened not long before we recorded, said it had accepted the credentials of the ambassador of Afghanistan appointed by the Taliban and was recognizing the Taliban-led government as Afghanistan's legitimate government. It is the first country to do that since the Taliban regained control of Afghanistan in 2021. There have been other countries that have taken steps on the road to recognition. The Chinese government, the UAE, Pakistan, I believe Uzbekistan as well, have sent ambassadors to Kabul and kept their embassies open. Those countries and possibly a few others, I don't have a list in front of me, but have accepted some emissary, whether you want to call it an ambassador, a chargé d'affaires, or head of mission, whatever, from the Taliban-led government to the embassies in those countries, but they've all stopped short of outright recognition of this government. So Russia becomes the first government to do that. It will probably lead a bit of a charge. I would think China would be, if not anxious, then certainly prepared to take this step now that somebody else has done it first. And we may see some other countries follow suit. We won't see Washington do it, certainly. But I think this may be a bit of a breakthrough for the Taliban.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Thailand, where the Constitutional Court has suspended the prime minister.
Yes. The Thai Constitutional Court on Tuesday suspended Prime Minister Paetong Tarn Sinoach on the grounds of a leaked phone conversation that she had last month with the president of the Cambodian Senate, also former prime minister of Cambodia, still probably the most powerful political figure in the country, Hun Sen. Now, we have, I think, talked on this show about the border clash that took place back in May between Thai and Cambodian military forces. One Cambodian soldier was killed. Relations between those two countries have been trending downward ever since. Paetong Tarn had a phone call last month with Hun Sen to try and resolve things, and the contents of that conversation were then leaked to the public, and apparently she said some things. She criticized a Thai military commander, which is a big no-no in a country where the military still has, by and large, political control. It caused one of the parties in her coalition to quit, putting the coalition very close to losing its parliamentary majority and potentially collapsing. She may have violated constitutional, what they're calling ethical standards, when she criticized the Thai military, at least the commander of the border unit that she criticized on the call. So while that investigation is taking place, the Constitutional Court ordered that she would be suspended. And I really think this is approaching the point where that country's government is going to collapse. It's not quite there yet, but things are just mounting at a speed that it's hard to see any other outcome at this point.
Well, Derek, you know I'm a fan of both plastics that are macro and micro. So tell me what Malaysia is doing by banning U.S. plastic waste.
On Tuesday, the Malaysian government said it would no longer receive plastic waste from countries that have not joined the 1989 Basel Convention on the Control of Transboundary Movements of Hazardous Wastes and Their Disposal. That is a category that pretty much just includes the United States. It includes, there are four other countries that have not become party to that convention, but none of them are exporting plastic waste anywhere else. South Sudan, Haiti, Fiji, and East Timor, needless to say. Of those five reticent countries, only the United States is a major garbage exporter. There was apparently last year, Malaysian authorities seized a number of shipping containers that contained hazardous material that had been improperly labeled. And this was sort of the final straw for the Malaysian government. And now they're just refusing to take any plastic waste from the U.S. at all. This is a big deal because the number of countries that are willing to accept America's garbage has shrunk dramatically in recent years. China was the first country to say we weren't taking any Western, not just U.S., but any Western plastic refuse. They did that in 2018. And up to that point, China had taken, had been sort of the world leader in accepting refuse. And so, you know, it's been a domino effect ever since of, you know, the countries, Western countries looking to other mostly Asian states to take their garbage and kind of rippling on from there. And then things get to be too much for the next country on the list. And it just sort of goes through that. And Malaysia now, of course, apparently is the next one on the list. Malaysia took about 35,000 tons of U.S. plastic waste last year. So where that's going to go, your guess is as good as mine at this point.
Yeah, I guess my guess is as good as yours because I also have no idea. Let's talk about Somalia, where Trump has ramped up U.S. airstrikes.
This is a study from the New America think tank based on data from Air Wars, the NGO that tracks U.S. Airstrikes in the global south in particular. The U.S. military's Africa Command has conducted 44 at least airstrikes in Somalia so far this year. That compares to 51 airstrikes in Somalia over the entire 4 years of the Biden presidency. There are some potential on the ground reasons for this. There's been fear for a while now that Islamic State's Somali branch was starting to grow beyond simply being its small presence in Somalia's Puntland region, and that it had ambitions of becoming a bigger regional or even global player in terms of terrorism. There's been a resurgence by Al-Shabaab, the longtime Somali jihadist group that has ties to Al-Qaeda historically. Last year, the Somali government undertook a major offensive against Al-Shabaab, relying quite a bit on state and local security forces that was pretty successful. But Al-Shabaab has clawed back a lot of the territory, much of the territory it lost last year in a bit of a resurgence this year. So that may partially explain things. But the other more obvious explanation is that Donald Trump just enjoys bombing Somalia. He did it 219 times during his first term, which is more than the Bush, Obama, and Biden presidencies combined. So he just seems to be sliding back into form. Somalia is a place where I think Trump or the people around him feel that they can project U.S. military power without drawing a lot of attention to casualties. And oftentimes, U.S. Africa Command will just refuse to acknowledge civilian casualties until it's really pressed to do so. In its strikes, it will simply say there were no civilian casualties as a reflex without any investigation, and only after, you know, if it's put under some pressure, will it you know, kind of acknowledge any civilian casualties that it causes. So this is a place where you can bomb stuff and show everybody that you're bombing things and that you're, you know, big, strong, tough military without drawing a lot of negative, shall we say, attention for the inevitable results of that bombing.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's stay in the region. Let's talk about the DRC Rwanda peace deal that was just signed.
On Friday, the foreign ministers of the DRC, Teresa Kayakwamba Wagner, and the Rwandan foreign minister, Olivier Nduhungirehe, apologies if I mangled either of those, signed in a ceremony in Washington the Trump-brokered peace deal that is supposed to end their long-standing conflict that goes back, state of conflict that goes all the way back to the first and second Congolese wars. It goes back to the mid-90s and the Rwandan genocide and the flight of the Interahamwe from Rwanda into the eastern DRC. Marco Rubio was there to oversee the event and I think signed as well as the mediator. The terms are basically, it sounds like the Rwandan military and the Rwandan government has agreed to withdraw the hundreds or thousands of military forces that it has in the eastern DRC, in return for which the Congolese government pledges to cut off its relationship, its support for the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda militia. This is the militia that's made up in part of the remnants of the Interahamwe, the folks who participated in the 1994 Rwanda genocide and then fled into the DRC. It's not entirely, obviously, it's got younger members who were not alive when that took place, but a lot of its senior leadership or elder leadership still has connections to the genocide. Beyond that, I don't know much about the terms here. There's been reporting suggesting that the withdrawal could be flexible based on whatever progress the Rwandans see the Congolese government making in terms of severing its relationship with the FDLRs, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. And maybe, that could be a point of concern because it gives the Rwandans a sort of a subjective basis on which to say, well, they're not moving fast enough, so we're not going to withdraw. Of course, this is all in the context of the M23 offensive in the eastern DRC. M23 has seized the cities of Goma and Bukavu in the eastern DRC. There have been reports of substantial human rights abuses and things to be concerned about out of those cities since M23 seized control of both of them. And M23 is closely allied with the Rwandan military. In fact, there was a UN expert report just came out this week suggesting that really it's not so much that the Rwandan military has been supporting M23 or enabling M23 as it has been controlling the M23 operation all along. And in fact, this is really a Rwandan operation that M23 is kind of serving a role in. I talked to Jason Stearns earlier this week for our special, and the way he put it is Rwandan forces are the ones that are making the gains, that are seizing these cities and villages and towns, and then M23 comes in and secures those gains, but it's really the Rwandans who are at the vanguard of this. Those talks, there's a separate track of negotiations between the Congolese government and M23 in Qatar. Those are still supposed to be going on. They've taken a definite backseat to these negotiations with Rwanda. But now that process is sort of over with the signing of this framework deal, at least, the devil is in the details always in terms of implementing these things. But it sounds like there's some impetus to get that cutter process between the M23 and the DRC back on track. We'll have to see what transpires from that. But yeah, it's certainly a big deal. I don't know that it's going to be that this Rwanda DRC deal is actually going to work out. Of course, it also includes the mineral exploitation deal that Donald Trump, that they had to put in basically to get Donald Trump to be interested in this conflict in the first place. That's a whole nother thing that has to be kind of negotiated and put in place. But there's nothing else. There's no other path, it seems, out of this conflict right now other than this deal succeeding. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Let's move on to Ukraine and let's talk about these Russian advances.
There have been a few things to talk about. The Russians have been really ramping up, it seems like, in the last couple of weeks, their overnight bombardments of Ukraine. just over the weekend, overnight Saturday into Sunday, they launched what the Ukrainians called the largest overnight bombardment since the 2022 invasion. Hundreds of drones, dozens of missiles. Ukrainian air defenses seem to handle it pretty well, although Ukrainian air defenses may be weakening here. We can talk about that as well. But yeah, the Russians have really seem to have ramped things up from the air. On the ground, there have been a number of Russian gains. The Russian appointed head of the so-called Luhansk People's Republic claimed on Tuesday that the Russian military had seized the last sliver of territory in Luhansk Oblast that had remained outside Russian control. So that would make it the first Ukrainian province to come fully 100% under Russian control again since the 2022 invasion. Obviously, Crimea is a different case that took place years ago. But of the four mainland Ukrainian provinces, Luhansk would be the first to be entirely Russian. There are also reports of the Russians advancing in Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, which is in central Ukraine. I think we mentioned maybe last week or just very recently, the Russians entered that province for the first time again since the invasion. They've now apparently taken a village in that province, so they're continuing to make gains there. All of this stuff is still very fairly slow. It's not a lot of territory, but it is relentless at this point. It seems like the just every day more. Again, we're back to a point where it's like every day you hear about another village, or almost every day you hear about another village here or there that the Russians have taken. So they seem to be back on the move in that sense.
And what about the United States freezing military aid?
Yeah, Politico reported this on Monday that the Defense Department is halting what it said were shipments of some air defense missiles and other precision munitions to Ukraine out of concern about stockpiles of U.S. weapons that the U.S. is, the Pentagon is sort of worried, I guess, that it's running short of these things. I don't know how salient that is. Obviously, there is an ideological basis for this. The Trump base has an affinity for Russia over Ukraine, at least in this conflict. So, you know, the decision to finally freeze, and these are weapons that were appropriated, earmarked for Ukraine under the Biden administration. So it's not, these aren't new appropriations of aid. The Trump administration hasn't made any new promises of aid to the Ukrainians. This is stuff that was already promised to them. And suspending that stuff is you know, could be a political appeal to the Trump base, particularly as some portion of that base seem to be less than thrilled with bombing Iran and potentially getting the U.S. into an extended military conflict in the Middle East. So there is an ideological component to this, but the stated justification is that the U.S. is worried about running out of these weapons. In particular, the decision to freeze air defense munitions, and I assume that would mean Patriot missiles, effectively, among other things, but Patriots would certainly be the main item. That's a huge blow to the Ukrainians, who, again, as I said, are facing these ramped up Russian air attacks, to be doing that at a time when your air defense munitions are potentially running out is probably not the greatest situation in which to find oneself.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about what's going on in Haiti, where the United Nations says that the security situation is worsening.
Yes, the director of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, Ghada Fati Wali, told the UN Security Council on Wednesday they estimate that Haitian gangs now control 90% of Port-au-Prince. That is up from around 85% just a couple of months ago. So the gangs are still on the move. There's also escalating reports of gang violence outside the capital. In particular, they seem to be targeting convoys of police and customs officials outside the capital, but there also have been attacks on communities outside Port-au-Prince in what looked like an attempt to sort of expand gang control to other parts of the country. this comes, you know, in the context of this multinational force, this Kenyan-led force that was supposed to step in and assist Haitian police in wrangling these gangs and bringing them to heel. That force is still stuck in basically limbo at this point. It's gotten about 40% of the 2,500 security personnel that were is supposed to be attached to it. It's received only a fraction of the financial and material support it was supposed to get, and really has been, I don't know if non-factor is the right term, but certainly not any sort of decisive factor in terms of helping the Haitian security forces regain control of the country.
And let's end on this U.S.-China deal.
Big stuff. It's the third one of these, I think. There was the Switzerland deal last month, and then there was the London deal earlier this month that was supposed to clarify the Switzerland deal. And now we have apparently another trade agreement that's supposed to govern the implementation of the London deal that clarified the Switzerland deal. So we're officially in inception territory at this point, I think. But yes, the U.S. and Chinese governments announced another trade agreement on Friday. This one is supposed to, in particular, focus on the trade in critical minerals, which as of earlier in the week, there were still reports that the Chinese government was throttling those, basically, you know, if not outright banning their export to U.S. companies, then at least de facto banning them. Now, this new framework is supposed to free this up, and you're supposed to see the Chinese government start approving the export of critical minerals for electronics and other manufacturing needs to U.S. firms, in return for which, this is very vague, but the Chinese government said that the U.S. had agreed to, I'm quoting here, cancel a series of restrictive measures against China. I have no idea what those are. But that was the level of detail that you're dealing with. And I think if that's what they agreed to, you're probably going to have to get a fourth agreement here to specify the implementation of the deal, the clarification of the original deal. We're likely to continue this process. Nevertheless, there's some U.S. manufacturers I'm sure would be happy to hear that they're going to be able to get break the stranglehold or the bottleneck that Beijing has put on the critical minerals trade. To what extent or what types of firms may expect relief from this, it's unclear. China is still, I think, going to restrict the trade in those minerals to firms that have any sort of defense application or connection to the U.S. military. But, you know, again, we'll see how that plays out.
Well, thank you, Derek, and thank you, everyone, for listening. And again, please check out welcometothecrusades.com. We really think you'd like this series we did. And also keep on the lookout for that announcement that I announced in the intro. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.